SaaS Backwards is sponsored by Austin Lawrence Group, specializing in demand gen for SaaS. It sure is noisy. I deleted 100 emails from vendors just this morning. Your buyer has gotten better at ignoring you, and you're going to need a big idea if you want to cut through all that clutter. Austin Lawrence is just the right agency to help you find it. So if your campaigns are falling on deaf eyeballs, let's talk. Visit austinlawrence.com today, and let's build something bigger.
Welcome to the SaaS Backwards Podcast, where we reverse engineer the success of fast-growing SaaS firms and explore strategies CMOs and CEOs are using to drive their businesses forward.
Welcome to SaaS Backwards, a podcast that helps SaaS CEOs and CMOs to accelerate growth and enhance profitability. Our guest today is Anthony Pieri, partner with Fletch PMM, a product marketing consultancy that also does website messaging for early stage startups. Anthony, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So I love your website and everything else that it has. I think your website says front and center, SaaS messaging is garbage. Make yours not suck. And I love that a lot because, you know, as an agency, we're always auditing websites. And I can concur that like at least 80% of websites out there are missing the mark with positioning. But I wanted you to tell me a little bit about your business before we get into the nitty gritty of positioning. So how did you get started and how did you kind of identify this as a need?
Yeah. So my partner and I, we launched out of a different agency that was more of a full service product studio is how they would call themselves, that did product design, product development, and even product management at some level. And so we started there and we were trying to figure out, is there a repeatable line of business that we can build around a specific problem? Because mostly the agency was doing custom services for different size clients. So what we uncovered, we went in with a hypothesis that maybe there's a need for positioning in startups, but that's about as specific as our product and our market hypothesis went, right? Positioning and startups. And that's very broad. So we started going in, we started posting on LinkedIn as kind of a way to fish out some of the problems, what was resonating, what was not. And we used it to kind of hone in on this really specific issue that we kept seeing bumbling up, which was essentially when you're an early stage pre-product market fit startup, you're a founder, you're trying to figure out the best way to position your product. And most of the stuff out there about positioning is like, in the early stage, it's basically going to be worthless. You can't really position. You don't know what you're doing. And so it's going to be bad. But a lot of these people, they needed to position in some way so that they could actually test to see if it was resonating with the market. And so we realized that nobody was really helping those people in that space where there is so much uncertainty, so much unknowns, but you still need to make some hard decisions. How do you want to position in the early days? So we started coming in there and we've been building this process and this framework across a bunch of different clients and companies. And we realized as we kept building this framework, right, all the different things that we talk about with positioning, what is a value proposition? What is a feature? What is a benefit? All these things were like, you see those Mad Libs, you know, we're the blank type of company for blank type of customer. All those words were so wishy-washy in what they meant. There wasn't like clear definitions for what, when did a feature become a benefit and vice versa. And we realized that we needed to probably map these things out. And so that became the genesis for our framework that we use now today. And we spent a ton of time, an unbelievable amount of hours, me and my partner, hammering out the definitions of each of these different things. What constitutes a capability? What constitutes a value proposition? What does value even mean? And getting these down to very scientific, mutually exclusive definitions. And so we would share our learnings. More and more people kept coming to us saying we need help. And so we started to think, well, where's the best place to actualize this? Because if we just deliver a nice, shiny PDF, hey, here's your positioning. The early stage founders, they need tangible things taken care of, right? They don't have the money to burn on research. They don't have the money to burn on just running fun exercises for the sake of doing them. Like some of the bigger companies, they can do these as, you know, team building activities and stuff like that. Early stage is like, we need to get these things done. So we started to say, well, where is the best place for this to show up? And we kind of ended up honing in specifically on the homepage as this is where positioning for an early stage company really makes itself very apparent. And so we niche down to specifically helping early stage startup founders with positioning and messaging as it relates to their homepage message. And then we kept even trying to niche in further. We said, we're going to only do B2B. We're only going to do SaaS. And then eventually we even found a subsegment of that group that struggled the most, which was companies with horizontal products. So products that could be used by a variety of different customer types and industries for different reasons. And so that was like all those factors made those companies struggle the most. They're like, we don't know what to put on the homepage. We could be used by finance. We could be used by healthcare. And how do we speak to all these groups? And how do we talk about our product in a simple way? So we basically have been building this framework from the ground up. And now we've worked with probably 85, 90 different companies. We do pretty short engagements, which allows us to work with a lot. And these become just opportunities to iterate in the framework. We treat our process and our approach like it's a product. So we're constantly iterating, shipping new things. And like in the same way that a product shoots out release notes with a product update, hey, here's what we updated. We post those on LinkedIn and that becomes kind of the flywheel for how we get more clients and customers. And then to wrap up the loop from before, eventually we realized that it probably made more sense for us to be our own standalone consultancy. So we spun out of that agency and then started Fletch PMM, which is the name of our company today. And the name comes from, I haven't actually shared this, I don't think, on any other podcast, so this is exclusive. But the name, a friend of mine, he came up with it. It's when you're putting the bowstring on a bow and arrow, or not a bow and arrow, sorry. It's the feathers on the back of the arrow that would go in like a bowstring. When you put those feathers on, it's like fletching the arrow. And what it does is it helps the arrow to fly straight and to hit the target. And we were like, well, that's kind of what we're doing with the messaging piece. We're helping to.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot.
That's the meaning behind it. Nobody knows that. It sounds cool. Looks good when we write it out. So we were like,
seems like you should put that somewhere on your website. Doesn't have to be the main message, but it's still good.
Yeah. Somewhere deep in the footer or something.
You said a lot there. One of the things that I was thinking about, you said you work with a lot of startups, and I'm wondering if you run into, you know, like a lot of companies will put like one form of positioning that is more about raising capital and then have to change it, or maybe they don't know they need to change it when it comes to actually trying to sell product. Do you run into that a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons why startup messaging is usually pretty bad. It's fundamentally two different messages, your investor message and your customer message. And the way that we found this out is that when you're convincing an investor that you're going to be a $1 billion idea, because investors are only looking for giant returns. They're not looking for the lifestyle businesses that are going to be profitable. They're looking for, are you going to really just, you know, 10x whatever I give you? So the thing that becomes attractive to investors is to say, well, this specific surface level problem in this industry and this specific surface level problem in this industry, if you really drill down, they fundamentally have the same underlying problem. So if this underlying problem is shared across all these different industries, if a company figures out a way to tackle the underlying problem, then you can make a good case to an investor that this is going to be a $1 billion idea, because it's like, well, once we do this, we'll be able to tackle this one and this one and this one. But the problem is that in the same way, when you run that exercise, people talk about the five whys. Something goes wrong. Well, why did that happen? Then you go one level down. Well, it's because of this. Well, why did that happen? And you keep going until you hit bedrock. Usually that bedrock level that's shared by all these different industries and contexts, nobody's aware of it. This is why the five whys exercise is so powerful, because it drills you down to the fundamental problem that is sitting underneath the surface level problem that everyone's aware of. But when you go to market and they take that investor message, which is all about the five whys level down problem, and then you try to market that out, nobody resonates with it because they're not aware of it. So when you talk about things like, you know, the payments industry is fundamentally broken or something like that, like that makes sense to an investor because they're thinking, okay, well, this spans across all these industries. But if you put that in front of someone in an actual job, they're like, is it? I don't know. I mean, I have a job. My company seems like we're doing pretty good. Like,
I run into that so often, like these statements that are like, is that really what people are looking for?
So yeah, to your point though, there are definitely two messages, and we only specialize on the customer message side. So we get people, not as much anymore because we've done a decent job of, you know, televising our positioning out into the world. We don't really get these type of people anymore. But in the early days when we had a more wishy-washy positioning, people would come to us and be like, can you write my investor deck? Can you help me with my brand story? And we're like, No, that's not really us. It's in the name, product marketers, right? We're going to talk about the product and how to market it to the customers.
Well, that's a great segue to the question about why do you think positioning is important? I mean, you're kind of stating it right there. And I think that that's where a lot of companies make the mistake.
Yeah, exactly. So to us, you have the most immutable thing in your business is your product. It's the hardest thing to change. Engineering dollars, engineering time, design, development, all those things. That's sort of like the immovable piece. You can obviously shift, but what happens is when you bring that into the market and you telegraph a loose positioning, but not very specific, you're going to get people from all sorts of different segments. So take Figma, for example, the design platform. If Figma had not telegraphed to the world that we are for product designers, and they just said, it's this tool that has these features and does these things, they would probably collect people from all different spectrums. They'd get product managers in there. They'd get developers in there. They'd get probably designers, and then maybe get graphic designers, maybe people who use Illustrator, like in Adobe, and they were doing it. And so you maybe typography people would get in there. So you get all these people in there. And in the early days, every one of those people would be bringing in their own situation and what they're looking for. And they would all make different demands on the product. So they would basically say, well, you should add this type of feature. This would make it so much better. And the product team, because the positioning would be looser, would start getting pulled in 1,000 different directions. And so a lot of times this ends up happening where the product, because you're appealing to all these different segments, you start adding on features for this one, for this one, for this one. And the product ends up becoming this big, complicated, bloated, hard to use, high friction platform that essentially doesn't really solve anyone's specific problems very well. It's a kind of like a lowest common denominator that does a lot of things for a lot of different people. And so Figma didn't do that. Figma from day one said we're for product designers, and they built all the feature set for product designers, and they became this giant, massively successful company. And then they used that initial positioning success to start broadening out and say, how do we bring developers in the mix? How do we bring product managers in the mix? And then they started adding other feature sets around the core, but still based on that initial core positioning thesis. The other example I like to use is Spotify starts with music, then they added podcasts, and then recently they added audiobooks. And so very clear conceptually related positioning. And you could say it's just for music, and then it's for more like audio in general, but it's broadening an already pretty focused positioning, but just still keeping it all conceptually related.
Well, then you have Amazon Netflix. Too, right? Like started out.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The other one is Netflix. Netflix goes, we give you other people's pre-made content in this cool, innovative way. Then we give you our own content that we've created, still very conceptually related. And then the last thing that they released was mobile phone games, like Flappy Bird type style games. And from what I heard, it's not doing very well because it's so conceptually distant from each other. And they could take that investor message and say, well, I mean, at the end of the day, these are all forms of entertainment, right? And you can kind of force them into a category that's really actually very broad. But I think the reason that people aren't going and flocking to the mobile phone games is because it's just so far out of their core positioning. So a long-winded answer to your question, but the positioning chooses so much of how you go to market, so much of how you do your product strategy, and ideally guides everything so that it's in a cohesive single arrow rather than pulling you out in all these different directions.
Yeah. And I'm going to skip to one of my other questions there because it relates. I mean, what is the relationship then between positioning and differentiation or specialization? And I see you all talk about specialization and niching down a lot, which I agree with. And you kind of alluded to it. But, you know, how does that relationship show up in the main positioning?
Yeah. So essentially, a lot of it's based on a who. Who are you targeting? And so when you choose a who, and this could be a who in three dimensions, is this a who based on a specific type of person? And my world is B2B. So is this based on a specific department? Like, is this for sales teams? Is this for a specific role in a team, like a graphic designer or something? Like, that's the who one dimension. Another dimension is the type of company. Is this for small businesses? Is this for accounting firms? This is for construction companies. You can have like an industry or vertical type slice. And then the last slice is, we would say, like by situation. Some people have used this by jobs to be done. They might call it a use case, but the situation is you're segmenting around people who are in a shared specific situation. They're trying to do something. And they might be in a lot of different groups. And the easy example is someone like Calendly, positioned around people trying to schedule meetings over email. And that's a very highly specific group, but it's also spans all sorts of different industries and roles because lots of people are doing that, but they niche down in that sense. So choosing these niches allows you to say, well, people who are in that situation or in that industry or whatever it is, what are they doing today? And because you've picked a group of people, likely you will have us, like we call it, the current way that they address that situation. And then from there saying, okay, well, if you have a current way they do it today, where is that breakdown? What are the limitations of the ways that they do that? And then what problems result from the limitations and how they do that? So walking out the Calendly example, if you had the situation, I'm trying to schedule meetings online. Limitation, when you schedule online, you don't have access to the other person's calendar and they don't have access to your calendar. So the limitation doesn't necessarily have to be inherently negative, but you can make it negative by showing why is that a problem? Well, because you don't have access to each other's calendars, you have to send 10 emails back and forth to find the right time. So right there, once you've set, this is the current way that everything exists, the differentiation becomes, here's how we do it differently. With Calendly, we let you share your availability with a calendar where they can just book based on the open spots. So you differentiate in one sense from the current way that they do it with these new capabilities. So like that's one aspect of the differentiation. But another aspect of the differentiation is if you're not doing something that's like brand new, like maybe you're just going into an existing product category and you're trying to stand out. A lot of time, the differentiation is taking the existing product category and adding a modifier that allows you to be one level deeper, one level more specific. So if you said that your search engine, you create a search engine, your DuckDuckGo, you create a search engine and everyone says, okay, well, you're a search engine. How are you different than Google? Why would I use you instead of Google? And they say, well, we're like Google, we're a search engine, but we don't steal your data. We're not going to track you. We're not going to steal your data. So they took the search engine market and they went to a smaller segment, added a modifier that made that small segment of people who felt underserved by Google, who was mad that they kept getting tracked and searched, and said, we made the thing specifically for you. So as far as like category creation goes, we are much more the subcategory creation route where we would say, take an existing segment, make it smaller initially, but then ideally that you get so much traction there that you can actually grow potentially beyond the original market where you effectively created a whole new group of people who love you that spreads and stuff. So the initial niching down doesn't mean you stay niche forever. It's just to get you the initial traction to then fuel further expansion.
Yeah, kind of a side discussion on the category creation, but I think that a lot of startups need to be careful with that, right?
Absolutely. And even the category creation people, a lot of the stuff that they talk about as pure category creation is really subcategory. Like I was listening to one of the main guys talk about an example where he was like, they created a whole new category and he talked about liquid soap, Purell was a new category. And I was like, it's kind of a subcategory from the broader category of soap. You shrunk it to liquid soap and it created a whole new market. Like that's awesome. But it's still to me, true category creation where you're like, this is something you've never seen. Like I would say OpenAI with ChatGPT, right? That's probably a pure category creation. I don't even know any comparable thing that you could even compare that to. Are you going to be the next OpenAI? Probably not. I think they come once every 50 years, you know? So probably not a good business strategy to bet that you're going to be the one for that.
So the fun question, like, how do you think companies are getting this wrong? Like, what are you seeing over and over?
Yeah. The main one being trying to speak to multiple groups at once, trying to position for multiple groups. And so what ends up happening if you say, like, let's talk about the benefit, the outcome, the ROI of using Figma to go to my last example. The benefits to a product manager are very different than the benefits to a product designer and are very different to an engineer. The three of those people have highly different needs, wants, and things that they're looking for. And so if you say the product designer, like a main benefit would be you can prototype way faster. And like that's one of them, right? Or you can collaborate with other product designers using these components, which allow you to reuse standardized pieces of design and things like that. The product manager is not going to care about either of those things. The product manager might be more interested in FigJam, the part of Figma that's like a whiteboarding solution. So like they're trying to get out ideas, they're running workshops and things like that. customer interviews, maybe. So the benefits for them are very different. So the problem becomes, how do we speak to all these benefits at once? And so what they end up doing is you have to go higher up to speak across. So rather talking about those specific tangible ones that are so interesting, you end up saying, boost your team's productivity or make your team work better. And then that is completely uncompelling to anyone.
Right. So, you know, one of the things we talk about is like, you know, your positioning ultimately has to move somebody off of a status quo, right? Like really your biggest competitor is getting them to do nothing. And those kind of statements just say nothing to me. And you're lucky if they dig deeper into your website at that point.
For sure. And so the difference we see it as in the early days of a company, product marketing should own the reins for usually how you talk about things on the website and a lot of your other aspects, because especially before you found product market fit, like how to market the product itself, product marketing in the name is kind of the key, right? And there's all these other aspects, brand marketing and things like that. But we think that those things become more compelling and more helpful as you get further along. And so we've seen companies that had amazing brands, but they had horrible product marketing and then they would die because they're like, I love how the aesthetic and I love the vibe and I love how everything looks, but like, I couldn't figure out what the heck do you guys do? And then no one goes for it. Where it's like, brand is super powerful in the early days when it's supporting the product marketing effort. And so what we see is like with taglines and these kind of vague statements, companies can get away with those things when the majority of their total addressable market can answer those questions about the product. What does it do? When would I use it? Why would I use it? How would I use it? Who is this for? All those different things. If the majority of your total addressable market can answer those questions, then you are free to replace product marketing lingo with cool taglines. And who is companies that big? Nike, Coke, you know, Apple, all those types of things. You can throw up all these amazing taglines because everyone knows what those companies do. It would be hard to find a single person who couldn't tell you what is Coca-Cola, right? Like in the whole planet, based on how much they've done over the last, I don't even know, 50 years, probably more than that.
Which is, you know, one of the questions I had for you is why do you think, you know, these companies are getting it wrong? And, you know, my theory kind of goes along with that, which is I think that most marketers have been taught by the big companies that are all about branding and awareness. And so then we go and try to apply that to a startup and it just doesn't resonate. And, you know, you see this type of positioning everywhere where they're trying to, you know, build brand and all that fluffy stuff. And, you know, they're not speaking directly to, you know, the challenges or problems that they're solving.
Yeah. And great to your point, right? When you get to a certain level, these industries become commoditized. So I think of airlines are competing mostly on brand because they kind of all offer the same thing. So the big ones have almost identical product offerings, but they're running who runs the ads the most, you know, who shows up in the Super Bowl and in your psyche so that when you go to book, which one do you trust more? Well, you know, I really trust, you know, Delta or whoever it is. And I like what they're about. So I'm going to go with them. But then you have these newcomers who are doing product marketing and they're differentiating and saying, I'm Spirit Airlines. I'm actually for people who are primarily concerned about cost and who are willing to give up reclining chairs, willing to give up space between their legs, willing to pay, you know, like just travel with just a backpack and nothing else. And so you have these newcomers entering the space and they're not doing it on brand. They're doing it on product marketing differentiation. We have actually a different product, usually positioned for a subsegment of people who are underserved by the big airlines. There's people who are like, I don't travel with a lot of stuff. And every time I go on these planes, it's so expensive. I would rather just go on a cheaper one, put up with the annoyances, but not have to spend as much money. So you see both at play, even in a commoditized market. The existing incumbents are kind of just competing on brand, and the comers, upstarts are coming in, and they're competing mostly on different products, which they do through, I would say, effective product marketing.
Which also is a really interesting discussion, and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but, you know, like, indicative of the book Positioning, The Battle for Your Mind, you know, they talk about, you know, if you're number one in the space, then your job is to, you know, defend that marketplace. And then everybody else, you need to be showing differentiation in some fashion with like the Avis, you know, we try harder, you know, we're number two, kind of being the famous example of that. But like the startups that we're talking about are nowhere near that.
Yeah, absolutely. They're in a different universe altogether. And by definition of being a startup, they're doing something hopefully different. They're not just, you don't see that many startups coming out being like, oh yeah, we're just literally the big, we're trying to compete with Apple. We're making a new smartphone. And some do, but a lot of times they fail.
Yep. So I saw on one of your posts about use case positioning, and I really like that term. I wanted you to talk a little bit more about what that is and what are some of the other categories you name and why you think the use case positioning is more superior in B2B.
I think so. There's an aspect of friction when you say, when would I use this? Where would I use it? Why would I use it? How would I use it? All those types of questions of like, where does this fit into my actual workflow? You can reduce so much friction just by helping someone understand where does this solution fit, not in the market, but even in their life, right? And so when people position with these broader statements, right, like increase the integrity of your security and stuff like that, there's no moment in the week from 1 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. I increase the integrity of my security, you know, whatever, profile. So by talking to these use case agnostic outcomes, effectively what you're doing is you're making them figure out, when would I use this? Versus starting with, you're in a specific scenario trying to do something specific and it's annoying, it's breaking down, you're running into issues. We've created a solution that helps you in this specific situation make more progress towards the end goal that you're trying to do. And so we would say it's very similar to, you know, you're familiar with Jobs to be Done. Jobs to be Done is these kind of two different modes. You've got the Tony Olwicks of the world who are talking about Jobs to be Done as like these functional steps in a process. Like, and their job to be done might look like, you know, cut a wood in half, like perfectly straight. That's like a job to be done in the Tony Olwick model. Then you have the Bob Mestin model, which is over here, which is more about desired outcome. I'm trying to figure out the best way to increase conversions on my website. And I'm in the specific struggling moment and I'm trying to get to this end progress outcome. So we say you actually probably need both. You need to take the best of both worlds, which would be, what are you trying to do from an activity standpoint? Like, what functionally, what are you trying to do? And where are you? Where is that breaking? Here's how we help you. And then what is that desired outcome that you're trying to get to in the long term by accomplishing this? So the use case message idea is really situating your product in a specific moment of time, something that I could point to on the calendar and say, from that exact moment, this is where the problem happened. And this is when I would use that solution. So like an example I've used before is with like a password manager. You could talk about the problem of password managers being like, you know, none of your passwords are secure. Like that's a problem, right? That you don't have great security. But that's not situated in a use case. The use case would be you're trying to log into your Gmail and you just got locked out because you can't find the password. Well, we have a password manager that in that exact moment, it would actually just bubble up the password for you. You click it and it logs you in. So same problem conceptually, but one is specifically to like a point of an activity or a process that they're actually trying to do. And it just makes the friction go way, way far down. And people think, oh, that would be great. So like an example of another one, Notion, really big, powerful app that can do a ton of stuff. But initially the use case that most people came in for was note taking, or like I'm trying to take notes in an app. And they positioned as this really cool new way of doing note taking with these, like, you know, block and different components, the way that they approach it. It was just like an interesting novel way. And over time, you come in for that specific use case, you start to realize, well, I could also use Notion to keep track of my calendar. It has this whole calendar piece. I could use this to keep track of my projects. I could use this. And over time, it expands. But rather than marketing that end state, focusing on the specific use case makes it so much easier for the people to adopt. You're effectively shrinking the product to make it easier for people to try and ultimately to buy. Where the opposite is, like we would say, maybe more brand marketing, which would be, say, you're taking something like a shoe with a Nike example, and it's not just a shoe, it's a way of life. Like brand takes a small thing and makes it larger. But in B2B, it's usually you want to do the opposite, at least if you're a startup. You want to make it easier for someone to try it and to be like, oh no, Notion, it's like a cool note taker. You should try it out. That's much easier than saying, hey, Notion, it's your second brain. It's going to replace every aspect of your life, of how you keep track of everything. Like that's
your one-stop shop for your brain.
Exactly. And people are like, hold up, but calm down. Like, you know, I don't even know. I haven't even tried you yet. I'm not going to ditch all these other things yet. So the use case, the artificial shrinking of the product just makes it so much easier to understand and get them into the product. And then ideally, it's once they've gotten in the product, it's easier to convince them to try other aspects of it than it is to pitch the whole end-to-end product at the same time.
So I don't know how much of your secret sauce you want to give away, but what process do you recommend that people use to determine what their positioning should be?
Yeah, I mean, we consider ourselves very similar to an open source software model where you open source, right? You let it out for anyone to use, and then you monetize it when people need help with it. So mm-hmm. That's essentially what we do. We share everything of ours online, on LinkedIn, publicly. So you can find the end-to-end exact process we run. So at a high level, what we try to do is we try to figure out, okay, who is going to be the audience that you want to focus on and figure out what's the right slice. Is it going to be a vertical slice, a horizontal slice, some combination? Who do we want to kind of be the champion? We would say is like, who are we targeting at a deeper level of like, we want this level seniority person to land on our homepage, or like, that's the person that we want to try to tailor our messaging for. And then really it's trying to deep dive into their situation of saying, and usually we'll ask a founder when we work with them in our one-on-one consulting, we'll say, what is your prospect trying to do? Or what do you help them do? And they'll usually start way too high level. They'll say, they're really trying to improve their business processes. And then we say, great, let's get a little more specific. And so we have a bunch of basically layers where we just start punching down. We go more specific. Well, what does that mean? What types of activities would they be doing to improve their business? Well, they're going to be looking at their finances and trying to see where things are spending. So we'll write that out on a line. And then we might drill even further down. What does that mean, looking at their finances? Well, they're comparing last month's performance to this. So we get this giant exhaustive list of their situation mapped out specifically, like sequentially, this they're doing this piece and this piece. And then we ask two simple questions. Where's the pain the biggest? Which row does the pain really show up the most? That's on one side. And then on the other side, we say, where does your product make the biggest difference? And that's on the other side. And if you've done a really good job of product discovery and product management and product strategy, those two things will be the same answer. The pain's the biggest here, and that's where we've created the best feature. But a lot of times it's not. They're mismatched. Well, they have a lot of pain over here, but we didn't really build anything for that. Everything we built was up here because it was cool and, you know, it had AI, and our team liked to talk about that. So we went over there. So what we try to do then is once you've mapped that out at the situation level, then we say, okay, which one of these do we want to make an argument around? And we're essentially trying to get them to go as specific as they feel comfortable going. And so if they pick a high level one, we say, can we go more specific? And maybe we'll drill down a couple levels. And then ultimately what we're doing is figuring out, okay, well, if this is the right level, what are like the three main arguments that you would use to say why you help them in that situation? So if they're trying to, you know, understand where their finances are going or something like that, then let's say, okay, let's make your key value propositions of how do we help you do that? So it, essentially all we're really doing is picking a group of people, mapping out where their struggles are, and then helping align the features and capabilities that we talk about to that specific struggle. And ideally choosing it based on this is where their pain is biggest and this is where we can add the most value.
So what you just said is incredibly valuable. And I want the listeners to also understand that that's not just for positioning. That should be how you develop your entire content strategy. At least that's how I develop it. Like, you can take any one of these little facets and develop, you know, total use case blogs and position or white papers or whatever it is around those exact topics and get granular with it. But, you know, it's just an excellent practice all the way around.
And we've seen it used, right? We mainly focus on the website homepage angle because it's such an easy win for these early stage startups to get a really strong homepage. It just helps them in everything, recruiting people, getting customers.
It makes the whole process much more efficient if you get the positioning right on the homepage.
Exactly. But again, we always say this positioning should then bleed into your sales decks, into your content, yes, into your leadership. And we just don't try to tackle all those things. We don't pretend to be experts in each of those areas.
That's okay, because that's where we come in. So Totally fine. So that's really great. Like, I'm wondering now, what are your like favorite resources, like books, blogs, podcasts that you think marketers should be consuming? Like, I'm always looking for books on positioning and marketing and advertising. So what do you like?
Yeah, I mentioned it before, Bob Mesta. He has a book called Demand Side Sales. That's really good for like the use case, job to be done, situation kind of stuff. I think that's a great resource. I would say podcast-wise, I love Lenny's podcast. And then the First Round Venture Capital Firm has a great podcast about early stage startups and people growing things and like marketing strategies and things like that. So usually those are the ones that I recommend to people. April Dunford, she's the big positioning lady. You know, her books are great. She's coming out with a new one. So that's probably worth looking into when it drops. But yeah, a lot of good people on LinkedIn to follow. I always give the recommendation, Matthew Reeves. He's a good bud of mine. He posts amazing stuff.
And do you have a podcast?
We don't at this point. We've tried to take our own medicine and stay hyper-specific and hyper-niche first. So we basically just do LinkedIn, but we have collated all of our LinkedIn posts and all of our templates and everything into a big Notion database. So we do say people could get that if they wanted. We sell it for like $50. It's a one-time fee. It's on my LinkedIn and my featured section. So that's like if you want to see what me and my partner conclusively think about positioning, differentiation, go-to-market, and all those even specific elements like features, benefits, capabilities. It's all organized by theme like that.
And then we'll look for your podcast like on the Netflix model, right? Like when it, when it gets to that. All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast with us. And thank the listeners for tuning in. If people would like to get a hold of you, Anthony, how do they do that?
Yeah. If just to chat, you know, become buds, add me on LinkedIn. I pretty much accept everyone. If you wanted to work with us in a one-on-one consulting way with your company, you can fill out a form on our website. It's fletchpmm.com. But yeah, I'd be happy to chat with anyone and anyone who wants to get connected, just send me a friend request.
Fantastic. And if you'd like to find out more about our agency, Austin Lawrence, check out our website at austinlawrence.com. Pretty easy. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, please do so wherever podcasts are distributed. You can also find us on LinkedIn at SaaS Backwards. Anthony, thanks a lot for being a guest today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the SaaS Backwards podcast, brought to you by Austin Lawrence Group. We're a growth marketing agency that helps SaaS firms reduce churn, accelerate sales, and generate demand. Learn more about us at www.austinlawrence.com. You can email Ken Lempit at kl@austinlawrence.com about any SaaS marketing or customer retention subject. We hope you'll subscribe, and thanks again for listening.